Back together, you and I, Monday, August 16th, 2021, on Connecticut Today. Bottom of the 3 o'clock hour, we welcomed author, internet guru, and media critic Dave Pell to the program. In fact, he's known as the managing editor of the internet. We talked about his website and a brand new book he has out chronicling the internet and news cycles during the last year and a half, of course, encompassing the elections and the COVID-19 pandemic. Right at 4, we gave you live coverage of an address by President Joe Biden regarding the U.S. military pullout from Afghanistan. Ted Taylor joined us at the bottom of the 4 o'clock hour. Ted's company, Sportech, already has a role in gambling in Connecticut, and he talked about an expanded role for Sportech as legal sports betting is due to come online in the state in the next few weeks. Our next guest is an author. Now, we're not done yet with 2021, but I'm going to award this the book title of the year. Ready? Please Scream Inside Your Heart: Breaking News and Nervous Breakdowns in the Year That Wouldn't End. The reference there is to 2020. It comes out this November 2nd. Self-described news addict and the internet's managing editor, Dave Pell, joins us. Dave, good afternoon. How are you?
Hi, great. Thanks a lot for having me on.
Who gave you that term? I'm seeing this all over the material, Dave, the managing editor of the internet. That's pretty heavy.
Yeah, that's a big title. I guess I'm sort of the self-appointed managing editor of the internet. I go around the internet every day to about 50 or 60 sites,
yeah,
and I sort of edit the news.
Is that on your business card? I would hope so, right?
Yeah, it's on the footer of my email, my business card.
Nice.
It might be a tattoo or so.
Nice.
Here and there.
So you for the past several years, and I've seen your name widely, you keep an eye on what millions and millions and millions, Dave Pell, are soaking in left and right, up and down, liberal, conservative, on the internet. And my guess is your take on 2020 was that this was propelled to just new and ridiculous heights here, Dave, that still is engendering a split here in America.
Yeah, well, we definitely, the divide is as big as ever, maybe even bigger than it was in 2020. But the news addiction, which I felt I was in a rare group before 2020, is sort of a pretty crowded rehab room at this point. Almost everybody I knew, even people who weren't generally interested in news before 2020, sort of became consumed by it. I mean, it affected not only our country and our policies, but even the air we breathed and our personal health. So it became almost unavoidable. But I think we probably got a little bit too drowned in the deluge of news during that year.
Yeah, you know, Dave, it's interesting. I've always talked about that on my show and for years in this business. I really think it can become addictive. I don't know whether it's biochemical in our brains or all these chemicals that psychiatric professionals talk about. But there's this constant, what's happening now? What's happening now? Who said this? Who said that? That's not real healthy, I don't think.
Right. I don't think it's healthy, especially when it starts to blur lines between our real life and the news. The best example of that I can think of is the notifications we get on our iPhones all day long or Android phones about international news.
Mm-hmm.
I've always felt like the only news notification I really need immediately is something that's happening 15 feet away from me or closer. But for some reason, we've all sort of taken on the role of Batman, where we need to be notified when anything in the world happens. And I think the real lesson, I think, as news consumers that we have to keep in mind, and this goes for my product also, is that, you know, the first goal of any news organization is to convince us that news is an absolutely vital thing to keep track of all the time. I mean, yes, they do a lot of good, and journalists cover a lot of important stories, but the notion that we need to be updated minute by minute, that's actually a marketing strategy, not too dissimilar from what social media sites do and what other internet sites do. It's all about, you know, taking from a Vegas analogy, it's just trying to keep you at the slot machine as often as possible. So even though news has a higher value, social value, than some of the other products on the internet, I still think it's important to keep in mind that somebody is selling that product. And the definition of that product is coming from them, not from us.
I love that Vegas analogy. That's great. Dave Pell, stand by. We'll be right back with you. Name of the book is Please Scream Inside Your Heart. Breaking news and nervous breakdowns in the year that wouldn't end. More with Dave Pell coming up. First, traffic and weather together right here on WICC. Yes, folks, and to me, this is the book title of the year. It doesn't come out till November 2nd, but it's called Please Scream Inside Your Heart. Breaking news and nervous breakdowns in the year that wouldn't end. Dave Pell is the guest, a self-described news addict. He's been called the internet's managing editor, and check out his Next Draft newsletter. Go to nextdraft.com. That's nextdraft.com. Dave, one thing that's really driven me crazy over the past couple, 3-4 years is the confirmation bias thing that we see every day, and the fact that people, Dave, on the left and the right will glom on to these obviously bogus news sites, you know, yourpatriotnews.com or leftlean.com, and they'll send me stuff or they'll talk about it on this show. And I said, well, where are you getting that? Who's verifying that story? Where's it coming from? You know, the confirmation bias, Dave Pell, is just driving me crazy.
Yeah, it's a big problem. And we also just live in completely different news universes. It's sort of ironic that the two sides of America, the two news universes, are furious at each other about how they react to every story, but they're not actually even experiencing the same stories. It used to be that maybe we'd get a different twist on the same story depending on our politics, but now we're living in totally different news universes. And so we're getting angry at people who are on a completely different page, and it's really counterproductive. I was lucky enough to work with the Center for Constructive Communication at the MIT Media Lab for a section of my book. And what they did for me is my book sort of goes month by month about the craziness that took over America in 2020. And they have data on what stories were shared by people on Twitter by each month, according to each month. And so we compared followers of Rachel Maddow on Twitter, what stories they were sharing, mm-hmm. versus followers of Sean Hannity and Tucker Carlson, and there is no overlap whatsoever about COVID, about the election, about the impeachment, about Black Lives Matter. Almost no overlap at all in the top stories. So it really is shocking how isolated we can be on an open platform like the internet.
And Dave, I talk about that on my show all the time, and as conservative as I am, I say, hey, listen, don't pin somebody to the wall because you don't agree with them. Because you know what, Dave? There are too many people who really shouldn't, about what other people have experienced in their lives. And maybe there is a reason, Dave, that they gravitate to one source or another. Maybe it confirms something for them. But there's a reason they're looking for that confirmation. And I think the biggest thing that worries me, Dave, is that we don't have respect anymore for what other people are experiencing.
Yeah, I think that's true. And we don't have enough contact with each other. I mean, as long as we're separated, it's easy for people to caricature the other side, politicians or the media, or to only tell the story of the extremes. I always tell people, I've never hated anybody in real life as I hate the caricature of the Trump voter that's created in the media. Mm. So how is that possible that in real life, I never meet anybody that I don't have something in common with?
Yeah.
I never have a hard time talking to people or finding common ground, whether it's sports or entertainment or our families. But when I read the news version of people, I think, man, there's nothing I could connect with on this caricature. And I'm sure they feel the same way about me. And that's really the biggest problem. We've lost empathy because we're not seeing people as people. We're seeing them as headlines.
Dave Pell, finally, in about the minute we have left here, and again, folks, the name of the book is Please Scream Inside Your Heart, Breaking News and Nervous Breakdowns in the Year That Wouldn't End. Where do you see, what do you think, Dave Pell, will be the next major development here in the news business and social media going forward?
Well, right now, the biggest thing you're seeing is a lot of name brand journalists leaving their publications and going to services like Substack, where they're going one-to-one and sending newsletters like I do, but sending newsletters out to their subscribers and then charging for those newsletters. So that's the biggest trend. The good news is that indie people and journalists can make the money they deserve by going direct to consumers. The bad news or the worrying news is that that's more content that doesn't have an editor or a managing editor looking over it. So I worry that it's only going to increase the divide and the amount of fake news out there.
Great stuff. Dave Pell, thank you. Check out nextdraft.com, folks, nextdraft.com as well. Dave Pell, it's been a pleasure. Hopefully we can talk in the future. Good luck with the new book, and be good. Thank you.
Thanks a lot. I really appreciate it.
Appreciate it. Dave Pell there. Nextdraft.com. Once again, the name of the book, Please Scream Inside Your Heart. Breaking news and nervous breakdowns in the year that wouldn't end.
Unfolding situation in Afghanistan. The developments that have taken place in the last week, and the steps we're taking to address the rapidly evolving events. My national security team and I have been closely monitoring the situation on the ground in Afghanistan and moving quickly to execute the plans we had put in place to respond to every constituency, including and contingency, including the rapid collapse we're seeing now. I'll speak more in a moment about the specific steps we're taking. But I want to remind everyone how we got here and what America's interests are in Afghanistan. We went to Afghanistan almost 20 years ago with clear goals. Get those who attacked us on September 11, 2001, and make sure al-Qaeda could not use Afghanistan as a base from which to attack us again. We did that. We severely degraded al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. We never gave up the hunt for Osama bin Laden, and we got him. That was a decade ago. Our mission in Afghanistan was never supposed to be nation building. It was never supposed to be creating a unified, centralized democracy. Our only vital national interest in Afghanistan remains today what it has always been, preventing a terrorist attack on America's homeland. I've argued for many years that our mission should be narrowly focused on counterterrorism, not counterinsurgency or nation building. That's why I opposed the surge when it was proposed in 2009 when I was vice president. And that's why, as president, I'm adamant that we focus on the threats we face today in 2021, not yesterday's threats. Today, the terrorist threat has metastasized well beyond Afghanistan. Al-Shabaab in Somalia, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, Al-Nusra in Syria, ISIS attempting to create a caliphate in Syria and Iraq, and establishing affiliates in multiple countries in Africa and Asia. These threats warrant our attention and our resources. We conduct effective counterterrorism missions against terrorist groups in multiple countries where we don't have permanent military presence. If necessary, we'll do the same in Afghanistan. We've developed counterterrorism over-the-horizon capability that will allow us to keep our eyes firmly fixed on the direct threats to the United States in the region and act quickly and decisively if needed. When I came into office, I inherited a deal that President Trump negotiated with the Taliban. Under his agreement, U.S. forces would be out of Afghanistan by May 1, 2021, just a little over 3 months after I took office. U.S. forces had already drawn down during the Trump administration from roughly 15,500 American forces to 2,500 troops in country. And the Taliban was at its strongest militarily since 2001. The choice I had to make as your president was either to follow through on that agreement or be prepared to go back to fighting the Taliban in the middle of the spring fighting season. There would have been no ceasefire after May 1. There was no agreement protecting our forces after May 1. There was no status quo of stability without American casualties after May 1. There was only a cold reality of either following through on the agreement to withdraw our forces or escalating the conflict and sending thousands more American troops back into combat in Afghanistan, lurching into the third decade of conflict. I stand squarely behind my decision. After 20 years, I've learned the hard way that there was never a good time to withdraw U.S. forces. That's why we're still there. We were clear-eyed about the risks. We planned for every contingency, but I always promised the American people that I would be straight with you. The truth is, this did unfold more quickly than we had anticipated. So what's happened? Afghanistan political leaders gave up and fled the country. The Afghan military collapsed, sometime without trying to fight. If anything, the developments of the past week reinforced that ending U.S. military involvement in Afghanistan now was the right decision. American troops cannot and should not be fighting in a war and dying in a war that Afghan forces are not willing to fight for themselves. We spent over $1 trillion. We trained and equipped an Afghan military force of some 300,000 strong, incredibly well equipped, a force larger in size than the militaries of many of our NATO allies. We gave them every tool they could need. We paid their salaries, provided for the maintenance of their air force, something the Taliban doesn't have. Taliban does not have an air force. We provided close air support. We gave them every chance to determine their own future. What we could not provide them was the will to fight for that future. There's some very brave and capable Afghan special forces units and soldiers. But if Afghanistan is unable to mount any real resistance to the Taliban now, there is no chance that 1 year, 1 more year, 5 more years, or 20 more years of U.S. military boots on the ground would have made any difference. And here's what I believe to my core. It is wrong to order American troops to step up when Afghanistan's own armed forces would not. If the political leaders of Afghanistan were unable to come together for the good of their people, unable to negotiate for the future of their country when the chips were down, they would never have done so while U.S. troops remained in Afghanistan, bearing the brunt of the fighting for them. And our true strategic competitors, China and Russia, would love nothing more than the United States to continue to funnel billions of dollars in resources and attention into stabilizing Afghanistan indefinitely. When I hosted President Ghani and Chairman Abdullah at the White House in June, and again when I spoke by phone to Ghani in July, we had very frank conversations. We talked about how Afghanistan should prepare to fight their civil wars after the U.S. military departed, to clean up the corruption in government so the government could function for the Afghan people. We talked extensively about the need for Afghan leaders to unite politically. They failed to do any of that. I also urged them to engage in diplomacy, to seek a political settlement with the Taliban. This advice was flatly refused. Mr. Ghani insisted that the Afghan forces would fight. But obviously he was wrong. So I'm left again to ask of those who argue that we should stay, how many more generations of America's daughters and sons would you have me send to fight Afghanistan's civil war when Afghan troops will not? How many more lives, American lives, is it worth? How many endless rows of headstones at Arlington National Cemetery? I'm clear on my answer. I will not repeat the mistakes we've made in the past. Mistake of staying and fighting indefinitely in a conflict that is not in the national interest of the United States, of doubling down on a civil war in a foreign country, of attempting to remake a country through the endless military deployments of U.S. forces. Those are the mistakes we cannot continue to repeat, because we have significant vital interests in the world that we cannot afford to ignore. I also want to acknowledge how painful this is to so many of us. The scenes we're seeing in Afghanistan, they're gut-wrenching, particularly for our veterans, our diplomats, humanitarian workers, for anyone who has spent time on the ground working to support the Afghan people, for those who have lost loved ones in Afghanistan, and for Americans who have fought and served in the country, serve our country in Afghanistan. This is deeply, deeply personal. It is for me as well. I've worked on these issues as long as anyone. I've been throughout Afghanistan during this war, while the war was going on, from Kabul to Kandahar to the Kunar Valley. I've traveled there on four different occasions. I met with the people. I spoken to the leaders. I spent time with our troops. And I came to understand firsthand what was and was not possible in Afghanistan. So now we're focused on what is possible. We will continue to support the Afghan people. We will lead with our diplomacy, our international influence, and our humanitarian aid. We'll continue to push for regional diplomacy and engagement to prevent violence and instability. We'll continue to speak out for the basic rights of the Afghan people, of women and girls, just as we speak out all over the world. I've been clear, the human rights must be the center of our foreign policy, not the periphery. But the way to do it is not through endless military deployments. It's with our diplomacy, our economic tools, and rallying the world to join us. Well, let me lay out the current mission in Afghanistan. I was asked to authorize, and I did, 6,000 U.S. troops to deploy to Afghanistan for the purpose of assisting in the departure of U.S. and allied civilian personnel from Afghanistan and to evacuate our Afghan allies and vulnerable Afghans to safety outside of Afghanistan. Our troops are working to secure the airfield and ensure continued operation of both the civilian and military flights. We're taking over air traffic control. We have safely shut down our embassy and transferred our diplomats. Our diplomatic presence is now consolidated at the airport as well. Over the coming days, we intend to transport out thousands of American citizens who have been living and working in Afghanistan. We'll also continue to support the safe departure of civilian personnel, the civilian personnel of our allies who are still serving in Afghanistan. Operation Allies Refugee, which I announced back in July, has already moved 2,000 Afghans who are eligible for special immigration visas and their families to the United States. In the coming days, the U.S. military will provide assistance to move more SIV-eligible Afghans and their families out of Afghanistan. We're also expanding refugee access to cover other vulnerable Afghans who worked for our embassy. U.S. non-governmental agencies or U.S. non-governmental organizations and Afghans who otherwise are at great risk, in U.S. news agencies. I know there are concerns about why we did not begin evacuating Afghans, civilians, sooner. Part of the answer is some of the Afghans did not want to leave earlier, still hopeful for their country. And part of it because the Afghan government and its supporters discouraged us from organizing a mass exodus to avoid triggering, as they said, a crisis of confidence. American troops are performing this mission as professionally and as effectively as they always do, but it is not without risks. As we carry out this departure, we have made it clear to the Taliban, if they attack our personnel or disrupt our operation, the U.S. presence will be swift and the response will be swift and forceful. We will defend our people with devastating force if necessary. Our current military mission will be short in time, limited in scope, and focused in its objectives. Get our people and our allies as safely as quickly as possible. And once we have completed this mission, we will conclude our military withdrawal. We will end America's longest war after 20 long years of bloodshed. The events we're seeing now are sadly proof that no amount of military force would ever deliver a stable, united, secure Afghanistan, as known in history as the graveyard of empires. What's happening now could just as easily happen 5 years ago or 15 years in the future. You have to be honest. Our mission in Afghanistan has taken many missteps, made many missteps over the past two decades. I'm now the fourth American president to preside over war in Afghanistan, two Democrats and two Republicans. I will not pass this responsibility on to a fifth president. I will not mislead the American people by claiming that just a little more time in Afghanistan will make all the difference. Nor will I shrink from my share of responsibility for where we are today and how we must move forward from here. I am president of the United States of America, and the buck stops with me. I'm deeply saddened by the facts we now face. But I do not regret my decision to end America's war fighting in Afghanistan and maintain a laser focus on our counterterrorism missions there and other parts of the world. Our mission to degrade the terrorist threat of al-Qaeda in Afghanistan and kill Osama bin Laden was a success. Our decades-long effort to overcome centuries of history and permanently change and remake Afghanistan was not, and I wrote and believed it never could be. I cannot and will not ask our troops to fight on endlessly in another country's civil war, taking casualties, suffering life-shattering injuries, leaving families broken by grief and loss. This is not in our national security interest. It is not what the American people want. It is not what our troops, who have sacrificed so much over the past two decades, deserve. I made a commitment to the American people when I ran for president that I would bring America's military involvement in Afghanistan to an end. And while it's been hard and messy, and yes, far from perfect, I've honored that commitment. More importantly, I made a commitment to the brave men and women who serve this nation that I wasn't going to ask them to continue to risk their lives in a military action that should have ended long ago. Our leaders did that in Vietnam when I got here as a young man. I will not do it in Afghanistan. I know my decision will be criticized, but I would rather take all that criticism than pass this decision on to another president of the United States, yet another one, a fifth one, because it's the right one, it's the right decision for our people, the right one for our brave service members who risk their lives serving our nation, and it's the right one for America. Thank you. May God protect our troops, our diplomats, and all brave Americans serving in harm's way.
And we continue right here on Connecticut Today with Paul Pacelli, your host on WICC 600 on the radio and at WICC600.com, online, of course, 24/7, 365. Well, you know by now, because we've been talking about it for the past 2 years or so on this show. Yes, finally, casino gaming and online sports gambling is going to be with us maybe in a month or so. A lot of people have hands in this. The Native American tribes, FanDuel, DraftKings, a company called Rush Street, the Connecticut Lottery, and a company called Sport Tech. And we've had this gentleman gentleman on before. He's a happy man with this now. Ted Taylor is the president of Sport Tech. Ted, good to have you back on WICC. How are you?
Yeah, great, Paul. Good to be here, and thanks for listening to us.
Well, Ted, I wanted to talk to you again because I know after several months of talks and sometimes contentious negotiations, several entities are going to have a hand here, including your company, Ted, Sport Tech, in the coming introduction, maybe in a few weeks, of online and in-person sports gaming in the state. Ted, let me ask you first, the way this whole thing played out, is are you happy as the head of Sport Tech? You already have a presence here in the state. Is this about what you thought would happen?
Well, look, fairly obviously, we'd have been delighted if we'd been one of the major licensees at the start. But, you know, frankly, the way it's panned out, we've managed to work very closely together with the lottery and the governor and the governor's office. And we've got to a good place. We think that we're in a great position to deliver something great for ourselves, and the state will do very well out of it as well.
Now, Ted, there may be thousands of people listening to us right now who are, in fact, familiar with your company and do business with your company, because for people who don't know, Ted, explain your current role in the state at the OTB locations.
Well, the primary business that we have here is there's two or three strands to it, but we run all what's called the paramutual racing. So if you want to have a place to bet on the Derby or any other race event on Greyhound or Highlight, then you do that at one of our locations or with our online platform. And we also have the Bobby V's restaurants and sports bars, one in Stamford and one up at Windsor Locks. So we have a retail presence plus an online opportunity. And in all of the retail locations, bar one, we'll be live with sports betting within the next, 8 weeks.
Is that about the time frame you're hearing, Ted? Because I know a lot of people are saying, well, you've got to get it ready for the first NFL regular season game, which is, what, 3 or 4 weeks away. Is that what you're hearing, more like a month and a half, 2 months?
Yeah, I think so. So it's taken a long time, and it's not necessarily the negotiations and contract with ourselves, it's been a delay. It definitely hasn't been. But there's a lot of moving parts here, a lot of individual companies required to pull all this together. And, and only once you sign a contract with the suppliers, so this is the lottery with their sports betting providers, can you frankly start ordering very expensive technology and terminals. Once all that stuff, and it's ordered, once that now starts coming into Connecticut, it's going to be tested and approved by the state. And, with the best will in the world, it's 6 to 8 weeks for that sort of thing to happen.
And, Ted Taylor, people should know, and you and I have talked about this, and folks who research it should already know, this is nothing experimental here. Wagering on sporting events has been a way of life, Ted, has it not, and in many parts of the world for years.
Yeah, it's been happening everywhere. Just in this country, it's been happening illegally. So you can easily set up an illegal betting account. And the problem with those is there's no control, there's no regulation, there's no licensing. You don't know where your money's going, and you don't have any comeback to the providers of the actual betting. But I'm fairly obviously not from New Haven. And, I'm from a country where, 60 years ago, they legalized it because they felt that was the best way to manage control and, frankly, tax it. So the rest of the world, most of the rest of the world, has got a quite well-evolved gaming market, which is heavily regulated, has changed dramatically in the last few years in terms of the way that customers are protected and the legal operators are shut down. And I think that's what gradually states over here are moving towards.
Ted Taylor is the head of Sport Tech. His company will be among many entities involved in legal online sports gambling when that ramps up, in just a couple of weeks. More with Ted straight ahead. First, traffic and weather together right here on WICC. And we are back, you and I together on Connecticut Today. We'll be back to open phones momentarily. First, though, a few more minutes with Ted Taylor. He is the president of Sport Tech, one of the companies involved in the online coming sports legal sports gambling operation here in the state. And Ted, we talked for a couple of seconds before the break there about ramping up for all this, the legality of such, which has been going on for decades in other countries. And I think you used the phrase customer protections or consumer protections. I'll talk a little about that from your experience in doing what you do already, what you see around the world, and the faith that folks should have in operations like this.
Yeah. So in the more evolved gaming markets, what's happened is that the regulatory authorities, so the state government, have said you must implement the ability for a customer to fairly easily control how they bet. So it's around the limitations on funding of accounts, how much they can spend within a certain amount of time, cooling off periods, that sort of thing, which gives the customers the opportunity to recognize themselves that they want to set limits around their play.
And also, Ted, I guess the customers should be also rest assured, should they not, that the bets that they do make when this kicks off in a month or two will be, highly controlled as far as security, correct, of debit cards and credit cards and bank numbers and tax informations and all that.
Yeah, fairly obviously the state's being very strict, and there are draft regulations which are a work in progress at the moment, which very, it's comprehensive cover for every aspect. And because relatively, Connecticut's quite a well-evolved gaming market. You know, if you think about it, the two massive tribal casinos, ourselves doing the Farrow Mutual, they're able to draw on a vast amount of experience that they've got through operating and controlling gaming already. So some of it is saying, these are the regulations that are in place already, but we're going to go to other marketplaces and get the best of class so that they can overlay that and implement that with the new sports betting rates here.
And a great deal of this, Ted, I would imagine, you mentioned best in class and getting the best. A lot of this, I don't care whether you're buying burgers, eating at a five-star restaurant, or playing competitive sports gambling, putting down money. A lot of it is, in fact, a consumer or a customer experience, is it not?
Yeah, definitely. You know, so these days, probably we're expecting 75 to 85% of the volumes of sports betting to be done online. But remember, that means that may be somebody doing it online within a retail environment of one type or another. So, we kind of believe that we've got an opportunity to create a best-in-class system and a set of retail locations in New England that people will come across borders to.
Yeah, Ted, I wanted to ask you that. Your company, Sport Tech, and Ted Taylor is the guest, the president of Sport Tech. I guess there has to be an experience on your end, correct, Ted, at the retail, the physical location, because you're going to have, Ted, I would imagine, and you probably have crunched the numbers on this, you probably have all the spreadsheets as to, you know, what percentage of customers, for whatever reason, Ted, they don't use smartphones or they're not into computers, they like to do their business face-to-face, mano-a-mano.
Yeah, we have a huge... You could go into any one of our locations now. We've got 11 that are open, and they have a wide range of differing customers. So we've got quite a lot of experience of dealing with all those people. And, it's fair to say that you've got multiple different types of people who want to bet in different ways and at different times as well. Some people want to come in and sit down for an hour and just play on their own. Others want to have a couple of beers and a meal whilst doing it with friends. Sports betting is a slightly younger generation. Some of the older customers will do sports betting, but yeah, there's a younger focus, and they tend to like, let's call it a more collaborative environment. They like to be with their buddies, male and female, and having a play.
Interesting. Well, Ted Taylor, good luck. I'm sure we will talk down the road. The gentleman who's been with us for a few minutes, Ted Taylor, the president of Sport Tech, one of the many experienced entities that will be involved when likely in the next month or two, sports gambling, legal sports gaming goes online here in the state of Connecticut. Ted, good to hear from you again. We'll hook up down the road. Thank you, sir.
I look forward to it, Paul. Many thanks for your time.